This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. More than 80,000 Americans are on waiting lists for organ donations, and most will never get them. Thousands on those lists die every year. One big reason for the shortage is that families are reluctant to give up their relatives' organs. Even when people filled out a donor card or check the organ donor box on their driver's license, family members often refuse. The need is so acute and so frustrating that more and more doctors are wondering whether financial incentives might persuade some families to change their minds and save lives. For some families, it's a religious issue, and there are a lot of other reasons, some rational and some not. Also, while we often have to make these decisions when we are least capable of it, just after we've lost a loved one. Is it crass or unethical to offer money? Is a little money, say funeral expenses, less disturbing or more? Later in the program, we'll talk about life in Toronto after SARS erupts again, and we'll check in on the first week of the French Open tennis tournament outside of Paris. But first, ideas to increase the availability of organs for transplant. If you've ever had to make this decision, we'd like to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. What factors did you consider for yourself or for your family members? Also, if you've checked off the organ donor box on your license, did you talk about this to your family members? What do you think might happen if the eventuality were ever to arise? Again, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Joining us now from his home in Orlando, Florida, is Dr. Robert Metzger. He's a transplant physician, and it's good of you to be with us.
Thank you.
What happens now when we sign a donor card or check off that box on the driver's license?
Well, for many who do that, the family is still asked. The public service announcements have always urged Americans to share your decision about donation with family members, but this is simply an acknowledgement that the family has the final say. What we're trying to do is to get more people to realize that this is a right of individuals to authorize the donation of their organs and tissues at death, and that this should be honored by the organ procurement organizations, independent of whether the family agrees or not.
Well, why isn't it binding now?
Mainly because over the last 15 years or so, organ procurement organizations have focused on getting consent from the family. Even though since 1968, when the National Commissioners on Uniform State Laws passed the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, or drafted it, that was subsequently ratified in all 50 states, that allowed anyone 18 years of age or older to gift their organs.
Mm-hmm.
But this hasn't been the process in the organ procurement organization. Usually they have always approached the family. One of the problems has been that there are few people who sign donor cards.
Mm-hmm.
But we're changing. Organ procurement organizations now are frustrated by the stagnant rate of organ donation, and we're looking more at the sign card as a way to get more or increase the consent rate. Actually, what happens when you have a donor document, other than what you said in the lead, most families will agree, and it's rare that they won't agree when you have a signed document. And this was especially noted in the Pittsburgh area, where the Center for Organ Recovery and Education now has looked at their rate of recovery of organs from those that have a donor document. It's 100%.
Hmm.
Yet when there isn't a donor document, that rate falls to 51%. So we have a movement to get more people to sign on to be donors and for the OPOs to honor that designation.
Even where there is a signed document, it's a little hard to see how a hospital would agree to go ahead and get the organs over the objections of a family who's willing to make a big fuss about this.
Actually, the shift might be easier in the hospital because since the early 90s, they've had to address the issue of advance directives. And so the ethics committees at most hospitals have already set up the process for recognition of advance directives. Actually, some of the resistance comes from the organ recovery people in the trenches who have always felt that taking care of the donor family is primary.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to say that that isn't important at all. It's very important. And what we want to do, though, is set up a framework of honoring the donor's wishes while we're respecting the needs of the recipients on the waiting list and continuing to care for the donor family.
Yet we also hear that, I mean, living wills and all that sort of thing, that isn't, nobody pays any attention to that either.
Well, they should be. It's the law of the land. And a living will, when you sign one, you expect that to be honored.
Yet in the breach, it often isn't.
Well, that's a problem in the system, then, that we need to address. But, you know, this is just respecting the self-determination of individuals to determine their medical care and to donate organs.
What's the hardest thing about convincing the general population about donating their organs? I mean, it's fairly easy to do in the abstract, but then again, when you're in the hospital, when this comes to decision, it's very difficult sometimes.
Right. It's especially difficult when the family doesn't know what the individual wants, and that's why it's so important to sign the donor card. There are a lot of concerns out there. There's the concern that if I sign the card, maybe they won't take care of me. There's the concern that the allocation system isn't fair, and maybe my family wouldn't be able to get an organ when they needed one. And there are concerns over whether my body needs to go to meet my maker in with everything there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, those are myths that we work to overcome. In the organ procurement world, we have a rule that then. There are no donors but dead donors, and all donors are dead when organs are recovered, except for those who are living donors of kidneys and partial lobes of the liver and lung that are increasing these today.
Well, let's take a phone call. Our number again, 800-989-8255, and Dave joins us on the line from Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Dr. Metzger has hit the nail on the head, and I'm the director of the iBank here in Norfolk, Virginia, and we've been using what's called first-person consent, or the donation designation on the license, for over 10 years with great success, and we've never had a family give opposition to us if we've recovered corneas for transplant before talking to them about consent. We use the driver's license as consent for donation. And I think that it's a miscarriage to be asking people to make this critical donation decision and put it on their driver's license and then ignore it upon their death. It's an important decision, and I think most people that carry a driver's license think that that decision is somehow going to be used upon their death.
David, that's right.
I was going to say I didn't expect an argument from Dr. Metzger on that.
Actually, Virginia is one of those states that has passed legislation with the donor designation law again.
Yes, well, and as you mentioned, since 1968, it's been the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act that gives agencies the ability to do this. And really, just one other quick point so you can get to other callers. I think that, organ procurement agencies, it's noble of them to put the family's wishes first. However, I think that is the main reason that we are in the organ shortage crisis that we are today. There are thousands of people that have the organ designation on their license that are potential organ donors that are buried each year. And if we would just follow their wishes, I think we could see a slow and steady turnaround in the number of people that are dying waiting for organs.
Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil.
And Dr. Metzger, we appreciate your time today as well.
Thank you.
Dr. Robert Metzger is a transplant doctor. He was on the line with us from Orlando, Florida. And joining us now from our studios at NPR West in Culver City, California, is Mary Roach. She's just published the book Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
One of your chapters covers the issue of organ, it's not called harvesting anymore.
No, actually, it's called organ recovery, and I kind of wondered whether organ harvesting had a little bit too much of a joyous celebratory ring to it. But organ recovery is what it's called. And I actually spent an afternoon in an operating room with a beating heart cadaver whose organs were being recovered, or harvested, however you want to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were three surgeons who came in one at a time to recover the organs. And so I saw that, and it was interesting to me. It was the first time I had seen a dead person who physically resembles in every possible way, that warm to the touch, still has a pulse, and yet this person is dead. And I wondered whether, sometimes that makes families hesitate, the fact that they're spending, they're looking at their loved one, and this person, you know, appears to be, seems to be, even though rationally they accept that the person is brain dead, it's very hard to wrap your head around the fact that this being is dead, and that may make the issue more difficult for families who are asked to make the decision.
The fear somehow that they would be signing what, in effect, would be the death warrant.
That's absolutely right, that they somehow, that perhaps science got it wrong, perhaps the heart is where the soul is, and that when that surgeon comes in and takes the heart, they had literally sanctioned the murder of their loved one.
And when you saw that beating heart, not only in the chest of the, well, it was a patient, I guess.
Yeah. They called her a patient, yes, until after the harvest was over, and then it didn't.
And you wrote that you couldn't believe that this person was not alive, and how the motion of the heart was so vital.
It was. I had pictured a beating heart as sort of something that is moving, but basically still, like a hand tapping Morse code, because you put your hand to your chest and it doesn't feel like a lot of motion, but you see this heart inside someone's chest and it's squirming around. It's just this very live looking entity, and it was, although I firmly believe that brain, you know, in the criteria of brain death for being the legal definition of death, it was very strange to see this heart beating and these organs and these, you know, the pulse going and everything is glistening and moist and just doesn't look dead.
Let's get another caller. Melanie joins us, and Melanie is in Easton, Massachusetts. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
I just had a comment that I think that part of the issue is education on the part of the public. I think people aren't sure who pays the cost, and the family may be worried about that burden, and also in terms of people making a donation, worrying about what may be left in terms of having a funeral.
And, well, what is left?
Everything. My husband's a funeral director, and if people make an organ donation, you still can send a body to a funeral home. The body is dressed for a funeral, so it's not like there's nothing there for the family to have as a last memory.
So from that point of view, there's really no difference.
Correct.
Yes, I would second that, having seen this woman come out of the operating room minus her organs, but she had been sewn up, and when they brought her to the morgue and she was in a row with four other bodies, you couldn't really tell. I mean, unless, no one has a naked open casket service. I mean, you wouldn't see the suture. There would be no way to tell.
The one thing that you did write, Mary Roach, was that she was different from the other cadavers there because she had saved the lives of three other people.
That's right. It seemed to me a heroic effort that most of us don't manage while we're alive. It was really quite moving.
Melanie, in your husband's practice, has he had much experience with this?
Not as much as I think we should have, but I think that becomes an issue with families where they'll come in and they'll say, well, we had considered organ donation, but we weren't sure what our loved one was going to look like, you know, afterwards.
And have you checked off the organ donation card on your driver's license?
I have. I did actually when I was in my 20s, and I had my parents sign it as the witnesses because I thought that would lead some credibility to it should, you know, the time come that would be an issue. But now that I'll be renewing my license shortly and I'm married, I will have my husband sign as well.
So this is something you've given some thought to?
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We'll be taking more of your calls and emails after we come back from a short break. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're discussing the issues surrounding transplant organs. There is a great shortage of them. People are dying on waiting lists waiting for them. Should there be incentives to encourage people to donate? I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cohn in Washington. We're talking about how Americans make the decision to donate their organs and why there are so few available. We got this email from Bev in East Lansing, Michigan. When my husband died suddenly of a heart attack at 48, my son and I left his body at the hospital and drove the 6 miles home. When we got there, I realized the doctor had said nothing about organ donation, which I knew he had marked on his license. We drove back to the hospital and had to insist to nurses and doctors that they abide by his wishes, not something you want to do at a time like that. Some time had gone by. The only usable organs were corneas and skin. Nevertheless, that was our only comfort. It's 15 years later now, but whenever I see someone with a skin graft that healed a burned face or a body, I smile. Well, our guest is Mary Roach, and she's the author of the book Stiff. And let's see if we get somebody else involved on the phones. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And let's go to Lisa Marie, who's in Carmel, Indiana.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. We had an experience, my own personal experience, was with my father's death of Alzheimer's at age 76. My mom and our family wanted to donate his organs. He was a medic in World War II, and we just all felt the value of that and what he wanted, too. His doctors recommended against it. At what point do organs, we were told, that wouldn't be viable, or he had no diseases? Are there situations, or at 76 years old and from Alzheimer's, that with no blood diseases, things like that, that that is true?
Mary Roach, I know that the great search is on for young, healthy people.
Yes, that's right. But my understanding is that there is not a specific age cutoff. I guess it's made on an individual basis. I would think that as long as the brain is functioning well enough to keep the organs viable and the organs are not damaged, that they would be taken for harvest. I'm not obviously an expert on the exact regulations with transplant, but I know that there are I have talked with surgeons who had made reference to an older patient being a donor, but perhaps there were some was there, you said the all of the organs were healthy,
non-disease. Yes, he didn't have medications for 5 years. No, he had no blood problems. He did have some malnutrition, and he had lost a lot of weight, but he didn't have really anything failing. And I look when I visit so many nursing homes now, as I have other family members, and that's something that I wonder if more doctors are telling, that it's something he should address, would be helpful.
Okay, well, Lisa Marie, I guess it is. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate the call. Let's go to Mark, and Mark's in Iowa City, Iowa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You brought up reasons, I guess, for people being afraid of donating organs,
and yes.
Mentioned, the family on one side, and an earlier guest had mentioned, I think, distrust of the medical system. He said something like, "Will they take care of me?" When I first got my driver's license, without talking with my parents about it, I had registered as an organ donor, and subsequently, when I went to renew it, I did not register as an organ donor. Although, I'm registered as a bone marrow donor, and I.
Mm-hmm. Well, why did you change your mind?
Well, part of it had to do with my mom being really scared that they, quote unquote, would not take care of me, and she'd mentioned.
When you say not take care of me, are you feeling that your body would be somehow abused, or are you fearing that they might go in and try to take organs before you were truly dead?
The latter. I'm not really worried about physical corpus. What happens
after you're dead?
After I'm gone. My mom had, or she told me that she'd read a story about some. Wealthy person in Chicago who'd gone and needed, I don't remember what organ they needed, and there was a kind of a nameless, faceless, inner city kid who'd been in an accident, and there are allegations that, he was...
premature, his organs were harvested prematurely.
Right, yeah. And I wish I could be, more specific, because...
Mary Roach, you write about not that particular story, but is this something that's in the realm of urban legend?
It sounds very much like an urban legend to me. It reminds me of the story that went around a few years ago of the person who wakes up after a night of heavy drinking, had been at a bar and left with some woman, wakes up with this wound in his back, this this bandage, and in fact, while they slipped him a sedative and they took his kidneys to sell, which is an urban myth. I was not able to. I mean, I asked about that, and it's not that. I mean, it's not easy to take organs out of a body in a hotel room and sew the person back up and, you know, head off to wherever you're going to go and sell them. And I would guess that what the story that you heard was an urban myth.
Well, joining us now from his office in Chicago is Dr. David Cronin. He's an assistant professor of surgery at the University of Chicago. He co-directed an organ transplantation conference earlier this month at the University of Chicago. And thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
How many Americans say they are interested in donating organs, and how many actually do so?
Well, I think Dr. Metzger highlighted that depending on the population you survey, about three-quarters of the citizenry of the United States is an advocate for transplantation as well as organ donation. But when it comes down to the decision time, that being when a loved one has been pronounced dead, and you go to the family and ask permission for organ donation, we drop way down to somewhere below 40%.
Now, some ideas were discussed at your conference. You know, given the acute need and given the fact that people are dying as they're on waiting lists, of creating financial incentives to help persuade people to donate the organs of their loved ones.
Well, we explored a variety of options, both live donor and cadaveric donor. How much should be paid? Should money be paid at all? If it was to be paid, how would it be implemented? Which groups would be for it and which groups would be against? And I can't say that we came out with a consensus statement, but we did come out with airing of quite a bit of information on both sides of the issue.
Now, one idea was for a relatively modest fee, something along the lines of defraying funeral costs.
That's true. That was floated early. And sort of the problem with that, or this discomfort with that, is if you're going to pay money, you're going to pay money. It sort of doesn't matter how you disguise it, whether you say we're just going to give you X number of dollars for funeral costs or traveling or hotel, or whether we're just going to say we're paying you because you donated your organs and here's how much we're going to pay.
And once you start setting up a market, then it's a market.
It may be a market, or it may be very tightly regulated, government-controlled, highly transparent, and anonymous, both donor and recipient, just as organ allocation is now tightly regulated, very transparent, and very anonymous. I would not advocate organ brokering with a third-party organ broker, as goes on in the black market now.
Have other countries, I'm sure other countries have dealt with these issues.
Well, the most successful one that we know about is Iran.
Iran?
Where they have state-sponsored financial incentives for organ donation, live organ donation. And they have managed to take their waiting list for kidney transplantation basically to zero. Now, it's sort of strange we're invoking the political business of Iran to talk about organ donation, but in fact, it is state-sponsored financial incentives for organ donation.
This seems, we all look at that organ donor box, and I guess most of us check it off, but it seems that that's one of those decisions that, you know, you can make relatively casually when you're standing there at the DMV that you really might feel differently about when the actual situation presented itself.
That's certainly true, and it's true in all the decisions we make in our life. The situation may change when it comes time to live by your direction. The thing with financial incentives for organ donation, in particularly in the live donors, it really respects the individual's autonomy to decide what they want to do. Do they want to donate or not? Do they want to donate as a voluntary gift, or do they want to donate to get some financial payment?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it allows more decision-making capacity in the potential donor.
Let's take a phone call. Amy joins us now from Sacramento in California.
Hi, Neil. I have a slightly different perspective on this. I used an ovum donor, which I paid. So I've already paid for human tissue. I paid for a live owner, live human organ.
Hmm.
And my opinion is that we live in a capitalist society. It's a difficult moral issue, and some people are going to disagree. That's what democracy is all about. We need to pay people. We need to start giving financial incentives. And, of course, you're going to have people who are going to be taken advantage of, but it's already happening in reproductive endocrinology. And so I'm just not sure why we haven't quite made the leap and start using organ donors for people who are in need. I mean, paid organ donors.
David Cronin, is there an analogy there?
There is, but it's not very strong. In solid organ donation, as opposed to tissue, such as blood, sperm, and eggs, the tissue donation is a renewable resource. You will make more blood, you will make more sperm, you will make more ova. You won't make another kidney or segment of a liver. And the risks associated with the donation are much higher for the donor.
Hmm.
May I make a comment?
Go ahead.
Actually, women have a limited number of ovum. That was my problem. I had, a very limited number of ovum. Ovum donors, where I went anyways, were only allowed to go through 5 cycles because it's highly risky for the women who are donating ovum. So I just want to make that point.
I'm sure Dr. Cronin would say there is a finite number of ova, but a much larger number than the number of kidneys that you've
absolutely.
Got.
Right. Absolutely.
Right. Okay. Well, all right, Amy, thanks very much. It's an
You're
interesting
welcome.
Point. I wanted to bring you in on this, Mary Roach. I was wondering if you had considered that at all.
I just wonder whether if you open it up to it being a financial incentive situation, would there then? I guess you would have to police it very carefully to make sure that there was not then the temptation to offer more or going to another state where you get more money for your organs. I mean, not that would necessarily develop, but it feels like we're inching towards not a black market, but a supply and demand economy.
David Cronin, does that exist?
There's definitely a black market in organ trade. It does exist. And it's despicable because the donors get exploited and the recipients get exploited and no one gets good health care and the organ broker walks away with the cash.
And this exists overseas only, is that correct?
Well,
or does it happen?
It's very well documented outside of the United States, but there have been, because it's illegal and a felony, it's not as ubiquitous in the United States as it is overseas. But I'm sure there are accommodations made on an occasional basis between donor and recipient.
And these are mostly live recipients?
These would have to be live because the cadaveric donation is very regulated and it goes by an anonymous allocation system, which is the only way that this would work because there would be, as you alleged, a setup of a cottage industry. Well, I'll go to this state or this
mm-hmm.
place.
Right.
It really needs to, if we're going to embark upon this, it needs to be very regulated and the allocation system has to be justifiably done.
Well, Dr. Cronin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
David Cronin is assistant professor of surgery at the University of Chicago Medical School. He was with us from his office in Chicago. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Mary Roach is still with us. She's the author of Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. And let's go get another phone call. Dave joins us on the line from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yeah, I actually on my card say only cornea organ donation. I have concerns about the slippery slope of organ donation. And my read on the situation is that even though it is stated that it is not weighted towards the wealthy, essentially it is, since a more wealthy individual can go to different states and put themselves on as many lists as possible, where an individual who doesn't have as much resources is limited to their state and maybe the surrounding state.
I think it's a national list, isn't it?
It's a national system. My understanding is that it's national and not state by state.
And I'm interested, you draw the line at corneas, so why there? I mean, why that one step onto the slippery slope?
The cornea is, you know, it's not a matter of extending a person's life who has lived a good life, but giving life to someone who is potentially very young, and the gift of sight.
A gift of a heart could be to someone young, too.
This is possible, but, you know, I have to draw a line somewhere.
That's interesting because I had a friend who drew the opposite line. He said, anything from the neck down. And I said, Clark, why would you make that arbitrary line? He said, no, I don't want to messing with my face. It was just people have very personal and irrational feelings about what can and can't be done with them after they're gone.
And I actually tell you, if a relative needed an organ, I would donate a kidney or what I could give to a relative. But I'm concerned about the general inequities of the system and that how organ donation might actually be working against medical progress to
develop artificial organs?
Or things beyond that, yes.
Yeah. Well, I think, as Dr. Cronin said earlier, I mean, the system is widely seen as fair and transparent at this point. It's the major problem that most people see with it is that there aren't enough organs to go around.
But I have read about some states where adjacent states have different rules and where if you're a resident of state X, you cannot put yourself on state Y's list.
Again, I'm not sure that it's
Alabama, North Carolina, South Carolina, I think.
It is a national list. It's not state by state.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, so there are a lot of misconceptions about this entire process, Mary Roach.
There are a lot of misconceptions, and I think that some of the unease, that people feel may trace back to the old debate of the seat of the soul, the heart. You know, does our spirit live in the heart or is it in the brain? And for centuries, it was the heart. The heart was the self. And I think maybe there's just people haven't quite in some way caught up with that they still identify the self with the heart. Mm. You know, Valentine's Day love songs. It's all about the heart. And so when the brain became, you know, the brain death became the criteria for death. I think people accept that. Yet when it comes down to that moment where you say, yeah, you can take that heart from my loved one and put it in someone else, and there's this perhaps sense of, well, will that, you know, are we putting, you know, our loved one into someone else? Hmm. So it's a centuries-old debate.
We're talking with Mary Roach. She's the author of Stiff. We're discussing medical, emotional, and moral questions about people's decisions to donate organs. We'd like to hear from you about why you've made the decision to give or not to. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Later, we'll check in with Toronto and SARS, Paris and the Open. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, Ira Flatow will be here with the latest Science Friday. Today, we're talking about organ donation. Our guest is Mary Roach. She's the author of Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. She's with us from NPR's Culver City, California studios, known as NPR West. And let's take another call. Leslie joins us on the line from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi. I really appreciate this particular conversation. I was a critical care nurse for several years in a pediatric unit here in Louisville, and Mary, I can certainly agree with your feelings of how it is kind of surreal to experience going through the process of having that person donate their organs. And I often, when I was taking care of a patient who was donating their organs and had been declared brain dead, felt such a personal sense of obligation to provide the best and most compassionate care to that patient as well as their family and stay with them until they went to the OR. And sometimes that might be 16 hours with that patient, but just needing to help them on that journey.
Well, Mary Roach, you wrote about that very process in your book.
Yes. In fact, there was a New England Journal of Medicine article on this topic where they spoke with critical care nurses and staff, and they talked about these issues, and they mentioned the very odd juxtaposition of, on the one hand, doing CPR on a patient who has been declared dead, brain dead, while in the next bed is a person who is alive with a sign that says, do not resuscitate. So, I mean, it must really... do a number on you.
I also wanted to make a comment as to the absolute irresponsibility and just absolutely infuriating joke of a nudie, John Q, with Denzel Washington. That, to me, that people rely so much, unfortunately, on movies and television to provide education on many serious matters, and this particular movie dealt with organ donation.
This was the movie where he robbed the bank to get the money to pay for his kid's operation.
Well,
it turned out
he locked down the hospital.
Right.
And was holding an ER physician hostage.
Wow. That was a different movie I saw. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. And basically, there was nothing in that movie that was factual. There was nothing in that movie that was at all of any benefit to the general community on organ donation.
Okay.
This idea that he could just shoot himself in the head, the ER doc could rip his heart out, plug it in his kid, and the world is right was just bizarre to me. And the thought that, my God, people are going to think this is how they do it. And, you know, bringing this person in from the car accident at the end of the movie that was going to provide an organ for his child, they had done no blood work. This
right.
woman was not on a ventilator. She looked like she was sleeping. And so the thought process is to the family, oh, so my loved one can be disconnected from everything. I can spend some time with their body, and then we can take them on and let them donate the organs. And I just
yeah.
thought that was so horrifically, it provided such a terrible disservice to the general public about organ donation.
Leslie, if I could ask, we have an email question to which you may have the answer. And this is from R.K. Hill in Hillsborough, Oregon. Can parents donate the organs of their minor children should the horrific opportunity present itself, or is there a problem with size and maturity of the organs?
No, actually they can. It obviously there is a size issue. If you have a six-month-old who needs a heart, you need a donor who is within that age range, or who is small enough. Sometimes you'll have children who are very small, just in size, and they may die in a car accident or some other immediate trauma, and we can harvest the organs. But it needs you have to match the size to the person's body. And there was another comment from a listener about state lists versus national lists, and the way that Kentucky does it, and I think every state does it, is when you have someone who donates organs, it is offered to anyone in state.
I see. So that may be the source of their confusion.
Right. So if there is someone within that state who meets all of the criteria, and there are many criteria that must be met, then that organ goes to that person. However, if it's someone in Hawaii that needs that organ, so be it. They will pick that organ up and fly it to Hawaii.
Well, Leslie, thanks very much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
And Mary Roach, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Mary Roach is the author of the book Stiff, which discusses many other things about dead bodies, in addition to their use for recovering organs for transplantations. And she was with us from NPR West in Culver City.